You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I am Patricia Nagel, appearing on behalf of Mr. Ezekiel Cuff. Mr. Cuff is essentially challenging the denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Mr. Cuff maintains that the plea was not freely and voluntarily made, rather it was the product of coercion brought on by the threat from his trial counsel. At the time, Mr. Cuff was represented by Mr. Peter Greenspun. Mr. Greenspun, by his own admission, threatened Mr. Cuff that if he did not take the deal that Mr. Greenspun had worked out with the Commonwealth, that Mr. Greenspun would quit the case, thus abandoning Mr. Cuff and his case.
But then, and your client acknowledged, there was a brief pause, and counsel said, well, I was teasing, or however he put it, I wouldn't actually abandon you. But that was just for rhetorical effect to tell you how strongly I feel about this is a good deal for you.
Well, actually, Mr. Greenspun stated, after he uttered the words, there were seconds passed. Mr. Cuff said, really? More seconds passed. Then Mr. Greenspun said, no, not really. I don't bail out on people. But that's how strongly I feel about this case.
Right.
So even if he doesn't bail out on people generally, I think that's a reasonable interpretation that he's going to bail on this case because that is how strongly he feels about this case. And
well, that's a finding of fact by the court below, isn't it?
Correct. And this court does not have to believe or the credibility can be disturbed on appeal if this court finds that the statement is inherently incredible as a matter of law. And I believe there is supporting facts and circumstances that totally undermines the fact that this was a quote-unquote joke.
So the court found it credible.
Pardon?
The court found it credible.
In its discretion, and as stated in the brief, abuse of discretion can occur in many ways, and we feel that that was an abuse of discretion to accept that. She's basically accepting it based upon her knowledge of trial counsel rather than based upon the facts and circumstances of this case.
Well,
it
wasn't just counsel. I mean, what he said was actually corroborated by other witnesses that he, after a brief passage of time, he made it clear that, in fact, he wasn't going to abandon the client, but it was this, I'm not saying it's the wisest strategy, but for rhetorical effect.
Well, I think that you have to then consider the fact that Mr. Greenspun uttered the same threat to Mr. Cuff's father. So if in fact this was a joke, why did he feel the need to go and speak to his father and say, if you try and talk your son out of taking this plea deal, I'm going to quit the case. Are we still joking? And even if we are joking, who decides how to receive that message? Mr. Cuff stated that
Ultimately, the trial judge decides how to receive that message.
I understand.
So you say this is an abuse of discretion. So I'm going to tell you our analysis of abuse of discretion. Then you work through it and tell me how it fits, all right?
Okay.
Either there's a fact that was considered by the trial court that shouldn't have been, and it was relied upon, or there wasn't a fact that was out there but wasn't considered by the court that should have been considered. Or either one of those are just fine, but the actual judgment of the court is so completely beyond belief that it's just simply wrong and it has to be corrected. So tell me, using that, are there facts out there that should have been considered? Are there facts that were considered that shouldn't have been considered? Are there any of those? Let's start there. Yes or no?
Yes.
Right,
first of all,
there?
We'll start with the misapplication of the law, because that's another abuse of discretion, as the court described. And as we quote the case of Paris and Justice, coercion can form the basis of invalid plea.
It certainly can. But whether this is coercion is going to be a factual determination in the first instance.
Okay. So we first start with the fact that the court is giving all this weight to the experience of Mr. Greenspun, and that the court cannot believe that Mr. Greenspun would have uttered such a threat. However, Mr. Greenspun himself comes in and admits, yes, I did do that, albeit I was joking. But then I threatened his father, too. And then I tried to get him pled in immediately at the time of sentencing, because then it would be manifest injustice. He would not have the opportunity to withdraw his plea. Then, even though he asked to file the motion to withdraw the plea, I never got the letter. But even if he didn't get the letter, by the time counsel filed the motion to substitute and the motion to withdraw the plea, and trial counsel would not grant the substitution until Greenspun could be there, he knew at that point that Mr. Cuff wanted to withdraw his plea, and he was still the counsel of record, and he would not file that motion. So I believe that there are lots of facts and circumstances surrounding this case. Those are the facts that the court did not give sufficient attention to.
What about the telephone call that was recorded in which your client says the counsel was all right, as opposed to, oh my goodness, he's going to ditch me and I'm not, what am I going to do? And that seems to cut against the claim he was coerced.
He indicated that Mr. Greenspun told him to say that, and that's why he said that. But I think if you go back to what he really said.
In a phone call from the prison to a friend, mm-hmm. he's parroting what Mr. Greenspun told him, as opposed to...
He says he's all right. Well, I don't really know what that means. He didn't say, oh, he's great. He did a great job. He counseled me on all of my defenses. He told me what the Commonwealth would have to prove.
But your claim is he was going to abandon him and it had this interim effect and it coerced the plea. Well, if that's the case, why would you just say someone is all right? You would say, he's awful, he's, abandoning me, I just don't know what to do, I'm at a loss. Something like that, you wouldn't say somebody's all right.
Well, I mean, again, he didn't say he was great. He didn't say, I was complete, he was a great lawyer or whatever. But I will quote what he did say. He said that I felt that my back was against the wall. I felt that I had no other option. It struck fear in my heart. I felt very nervous and hesitant if I didn't accept the plea.
Why can't the court just chalk all that off to buyer's remorse after the fact?
Because you have Mr. Greenspun coming in and saying, I did threaten the client for whatever reasons or explanations after the fact, but is that even appropriate in the first place? Which Greenspun...
Right, but the Supreme Court has made it very clear, we're not here to grade... trial counsel's performance, and the bottom line is, under this constitutional standard, was there constitutionally defective counsel representation provided under a highly deferential standard?
Well, then again, you have Mr. Greenspun stating at least six times during his testimony that he made his point. And so what was his point? That he was joking, or that Mr. Cuff needed to take the plea? He said... I didn't raise my voice or anything, but I made my point.
But what was the point? If the point was...
The point was he needed to...
If the point was, I'm an experienced defense counsel, you're charged with rape, forcible sodomy, burglary, attempted robbery, use of a firearm, wounding, and two misdemeanors. And I think, based upon my experience, this is a great plea, and you'd be crazy not to take it. What's coercive about that? Isn't that exactly what we want experienced counsel to do, if they genuinely, in good faith, believe it to be true?
We do, but at the same time, we want experienced counsel or inexperienced. We want counsel to recognize and respect the fact that ultimately this is the client's decision, not the lawyer's decision.
Well, Greenspun testified he did, and the fact finder accepted the testimony.
He did.
He did respect, he didn't quit the client. He wasn't, in fact, threatening him. He was just emphasizing the fact that, based upon his experience, based upon the charges he was looking at, this was about the best he could do. And unless we're willing to suggest that is incredible on its face, which would be hard-pressed for me to do.
I'm sorry. I have no complaint with that. I mean, all experienced attorneys will counsel their client, and sometimes the client will ask for a recommendation, and even if they don't, they may recommend what they think their client will do.
So what exactly is the coercion? What exactly is the coercion?
When you threaten the client, say, if you don't do something that I think is in your best interest, I'm going to take action that is going to be adverse to you.
Okay, very fair. According to Greenspun, he said something in jest that was not received as an actual threat. And as you just heard, there's evidence from the defendant himself that he didn't vocalize any sense of threat later. In fact, just the opposite.
I'm sorry. I don't see how we can say so easily that this threat was made in jest. If Mr. Greenspun goes on to threaten the father, he attempts to wedge himself between his client and his father by telling his father, essentially, you can't even talk to your son about this. If you do, if you try to talk him out of it, I'm going to quit the case. I mean, Mr. Greenspun is doing all of these things. I'm not screaming, but I made my point. Yes, I made the threat, okay, not in such in a meaningful way, but I made my point. It was a Peter Greenspun cliche, to make my point. And I said my piece again. Mr. Greenspun is at least six times at that hearing stating that he's making his point. And I don't think at that point he's making his point that he was only joking. He's making his point that he knows better about these things than the client. He worked feverishly to work out this deal. It was a better deal than what the public defender came up with. Therefore, you have to take it. And it's the therefore you have to take it that goes too far. That is way beyond counseling your client. That is way beyond suggesting to your client what you think is in the client's best interest, because at the end of the day, it is the client's decision, not the lawyer's.
What about the testimony from Mr. Greenspun that throughout the course of the representation, the client was less concerned with going to trial versus guilty plea, and his bottom line was getting to an acceptable, low-ish sentence. And that's what he said about doing. And so now, in hindsight, we're saying, well, yeah, he doesn't like what he got. But that's really a hindsight thing, that throughout, you know, from the outset, it was all about just negotiate a low number for me. Doesn't that inform the trial court's decision about the consequences of all this?
Well, actually, respectfully, I disagree. Even Mr. Greenspun stated that it was a two-pronged approach, and it always is. You're always trying to negotiate the best plea offer for your client at the same time preparing for trial, because ultimately it is the client's decision whether to take that plea offer, which could come in the 11th hour. You have to be prepared for trial. And so, yes, he did. And again, I think that's where we kind of jump the rail, sort of the train, is that Mr. Greenspun had done a very good job of negotiating this plea. And any trial lawyer is always fearful for his or her client. You are always afraid that if you go to that jury, you're going to get hammered. Okay? But at the end of the day, you have to always be mindful of whose decision it is. And you can suggest, you can, you know, give your opinion. But when you get to the point where you're actually uttering a threat against your client, I don't see how that can be justified in any way. It's easy to say, oh, I was just joking, after you saw the look of horror on the client's face.
I'm interested in what you said.
We get to the abuse of discretion, right. I believe that the court placed way too much emphasis on the experience of Mr. Greenspun rather than what he actually said, and as many times as he stated that he was making his point, and you know whatever his point was, which I believe was, you have to take this deal because it's in your best interest.
Have you calculated what the maximum sentence could have been for Mr. Cuff?
I'm sure it's probably a couple of life sentences, but at the end of the day, that's his choice. We see clients do that all the time, and in hindsight, you're like, you should have taken the deal.
So in a situation where, and I think you're right, several of the facts of this case are horrific. A lawyer being perhaps a little overzealous in how strongly he feels that this deal, 12 and a half years to serve, mm-hmm. on a case that a jury could have given them several, what, two life sentences and more.
Yes, sir.
I hope he knows that if you win, he may have to face that again.
And with all due respect, Your Honor, I've been in that position many times, and the jury will come back and burn the client, or the jury come back with something less than what was even offered, even if they find them guilty. So again, it's always the client's decision.
Oh, I understand.
10 seconds. Thank you.
May it please the Court, good morning. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. This Court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals for two reasons. First, the defendant has failed to preserve the argument that he makes today that coercion alone is sufficient to reverse, is sufficient to demonstrate a finding of good faith. It was never argued in the trial court. It was never argued in the Court of Appeals. In those courts, he always argued that it was a two-pronged test, that a defendant had to show both that there was a good faith basis and that he had a reasonable defense. Second, this court on the merits should find that even if the argument before the court today was preserved, the circuit court's finding that the defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty pleas were made in good faith is not plainly wrong. As the court has touched on, the factual finding of good faith is one that's subject to a difficult standard of review for the defendant to overcome. This court would have to find that the trial court's finding of good faith was plainly wrong. And below, there was sufficient evidence to overcome this challenge. The defendant in this case gave multiple statements regarding whether or not Mr. Greenspun actually retracted his rhetoric about withdrawing from the case. At first he said no, Mr. Greenspun did not say that he was just kidding. And then later in the course of the motions hearing, he retracted that and said actually he did state that he would not abandon me.
Couldn't the fact finder upon that one sequence, no, he never said that. Okay, he did say it on cross. Wouldn't that be enough for a fact finder to say, you know what, you just lost me. I can't believe you anymore. Everything you say is now going to fall below the threshold of convincing me?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the trial court did find that Mr. Cuff's credibility was not convincing. The court made an explicit factual finding with respect to that at page 531 of the appendix. And there are other bases for the court to find that Mr. Cuff was not credible. They don't necessarily touch directly on what Mr. Greenspun said to him, but he gave many different accounts about whether or not Mr. Greenspun and his associate had discussed with him the possible defenses. First, he said that there was no discussion of defenses. Then he said, yes, in fact, there was a discussion of defenses. And then finally he said, well, actually, I just don't remember whether or not we discussed defenses.
And who has the burden of proof of showing good cause, et cetera?
I would suggest to the court that it's the defendant who is his motion.
So without the Commonwealth saying a word at a hearing like this, if the fact finder says, look, defendant, you don't persuade me at the level of preponderance on anything, really. I don't know what to believe. Then the whole thing collapses no matter what the Commonwealth says.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so basically, additionally, the crux of the Commonwealth's argument here is that while trial counsel used rhetoric to suggest, to persuade Mr. Cuff to take the guilty plea, this language did not actually induce him to plead guilty. And that and the trial court's finding to that effect was not plainly wrong. You have, as I touched on before, that Greenspun's immediate disavowal that he would withdraw the guilty plea. And in fact, Cuff said, when he was asked point blank whether he thought that Mr. Greenspun's disavowal was genuine, Cuff dodged the question. And he said, well, you know, that's just not something that you should joke about. He didn't actually say yes. He didn't agree. Yes, I thought he was being genuine. No, I didn't think he was being genuine. He avoided answering the question. And that's just one more factor that the trial court could consider in determining that Cuff was not credible. As Justice McCullough has touched on, additionally, the day of the guilty plea, Mr. Cuff was on recording stating that he thought the trial counsel was all right. He was not complaining that trial counsel had forced him or induced him to accept the guilty plea. And I would just briefly respond to some of the arguments made by counsel. I would say that any statements made to the defendant's family the day of the guilty plea are irrelevant, because there's no evidence that that the family conveyed those statements to Cuff. There's no evidence that those statements impacted Mr. Cuff's decision whether or not to plead guilty.
Do we know whether any of those statements were actually relayed back to Mr. Cuff?
It sounded like they discussed the similar statements made by Mr. Greenspun after Mr. Cuff had pleaded guilty. They compared notes and said, oh yes, he said the same thing to me. But I think as the Court of Appeals found, the guilty plea only became an issue after they entered the guilty plea, when Cuff's family was upset that he was going to have to serve 12 and a half years. There was no indication the day of the guilty plea that Mr. Cuff was actually upset. All of the argument that he was induced to plead guilty, all the evidence arose afterwards. I'd also just want to quickly explain a point that counsel touched on during her argument. She suggested that Mr. Greenspun was trying to force the issue of sentencing the same day that Mr. Cuff entered the guilty pleas. Because he just wanted to wash his hands of the whole thing. But the record suggests that Mr. Greenspun was attempting to have Mr. Cuff sentenced that day because he wanted to give Mr. Cuff the opportunity to cooperate in the prosecution of his co-defendant. And his hope was that there would be that any cooperation during the prosecution of the co-defendant could be used as a grounds for a motion for reconsideration of Mr. Cuff's sentence. So it was not that Mr. Greenspun was attempting to railroad Mr. Cuff into pleading guilty and washing his hands of it. He was trying to, this was part of the defense and part of the strategy that Mr. Greenspun was employing. And unless the court has any other questions, I would just suggest that the factual finding of the trial court was not plainly wrong when the trial court found that Mr. Cuff did not make his motion to withdraw the guilty plea in good faith. And as such, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mr. Cuff's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. Thank you.
Ms. Nagel, with 1 minute left on the clock, you looked at me and said, do you have a question? And I did have a question.
Okay.
And in retrospect, my question really had absolutely nothing to do with the merits of the case, and then your time ran out. I'm asking the clerk to give you 1 minute, and you may respond.
Okay, thank you. As far as the credibility of Mr. Cuff regarding whether or not he was counseled on his pleas, even Mr. Greenspun stated, I counseled him regarding any possible defenses in terms of pleading guilty, but not in terms of going to trial. That makes no sense. That's a credibility issue for Mr. Greenspun, because if the person's pleading guilty, they don't need to be counseled on their defenses. You need to do that for trial. As far as the procedural bar, I believe it's page 157 in the appendix that shows the motion and the argument of counsel at the time in the circuit court that the pleas were based upon coercion and fear. And as far as the statements that Mr. Greenspun made to the family, the threats to the family, that goes to show the Mr. Greenspun's position in terms of how strongly he wanted Cuff to take the deal. And that was the purpose of bringing that. Lastly, quickly, as far as the sentence, being sentenced on the same day, that would have made it much more difficult for Mr. Cuff to withdraw his plea, because it would have been, the standard would have been manifest injustice as opposed to what the current standard is now. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Call the next case.